Today we're going to cover two chapters. First chapter we're going to cover is on the data warehouse. There are basically two major types of databases. The first one is known as the operational database. It's the one that you have been working with and building during the entire quarter. It's the type of database that deals with the daily transactions. So when you go to any store, the database that is supporting those transactions is an operational type database. Several years ago, companies wanted a different type of database. And the reason why they wanted that type of database was the fact that they were confronted with trying to understand and ask more complex questions. As a result of trying to ask these more complex questions, they realized that the operational type database was not useful for storing and finding answers to these complex questions. And so it was Bill Inman, I think back in the 80s, that came up with this concept of a data warehouse. So the purpose of the data warehouse is to find answers to complex business questions or problems. Another term for the concept of the data warehouse is what you would hear these days called business intelligence. Business intelligence is really about the ability to find trends in data so that you could do a much better job of satisfying customers and strategically positioning the organization to take advantage of certain opportunities that may exist in the environment, in the business environment. So technically then, a data warehouse is quite often related to the concept of a decision support system. A decision support system, in principle, has four major parts to it. It has a data store, where the data is stored. It has a data extraction and filtering mechanism. It has an end-user query tool, and it has a presentation tool. Data extraction and filtering is a concept that relates to moving the data from the operational database and actually cleaning it before we actually store it in the data warehouse. So extraction is a major component because the data warehouse quite often gets its data from one or more operational databases. And the cleaning process is extremely important because you can't find trends on data that is not clean. So what do we mean by uncleanly data? Well, if you have data integrity problems in the operational database, then these are some examples of uncleanly data. For example, you may have a customer or several customers whose information might be conflicting. I might have three different addresses for the same person. Okay. These are some examples of, you know, uncleanly data. Another one might be the way I spell somebody's name. Is it the same person is really the question, or is it somebody else? So any example you could find of data integrity quite often would be an example of unclean data, so to speak. So we try to clean up the data before we actually store it in the data warehouse. So one way to help you do that is something you could purchase sources of information from companies that sell information. One place you could buy stuff from is like the post office. Because post office usually have the cleanest data. Why? Because when you move, the first person you tell is the post office because you want to receive your mail. So you could buy those kind of mailing lists and use that as your benchmark for deciding what is good and what is bad data. Let's take a look at the difference between operational data and decision support data. Operational data and decision support data. That comes from table 13.2. The first thing we want to look at is the characteristic of the data. Characteristic here means, in this case, there are several characteristics. The first one is data currency. How current is the data? Well, for the operational data, the information is very current because it's operational, so it satisfies the daily. It satisfies the daily activities, and it's usually real time. Like when you go to Dominic's and stuff like that, quite often it's real time. But for the DSS data, which is the same thing as saying the warehouse data, the data is not current, it's historic. And because it's historic, it means then that it represents a snapshot, right? It means it might be from 2 months ago. So it's not current, so it's a snapshot. And there's always a time component to it. So in the operational environment, the data is stored in a somewhat piecemeal fashion, a transaction today, a transaction tomorrow. But if you want to find trends in the data, you need to store it as an aggregate. So you might store it, you might sum up all these transactions and store 1 year's worth or a month's worth or something like that, and end up with what would be considered like a time series data. And then you could, you know, explore that to see what the trends are. The other one is the granularity. Which is what I kind of touched on just a second ago. For the operational data, the granularity is atomic. We're looking at transactions and units and stuff like that. But in the DSS, in the warehouse, we're looking at summarized data. So quite often, the data is summarized before we actually store it in the data warehouse. The summarization level in the operational data environment is low. But in the DSS, or in the data warehouse, it's high. Just about everything we put in the data warehouse is aggregated, is summarized, so to speak. The data model in the operational database is highly normalized. We've been talking about that from chapter 5, first, second, third, normal form, etc. In the DSS, quite often, it is not normalized. And the structures are much more complex. Okay. For example, as you're going to see later in the chapter, the data model that we're going to look at is going to be roll-up and MOLAP. Whereas in the operational database, we kind of looked at the relational model and the relational structure from stuff that you've been doing all quarter. The transaction type in the operational is mostly updates. We're adding and deleting stuff quite often in the operational. We don't remove anything in the data warehouse. We just keep adding data. It gets larger and larger every day. And mostly all we're doing over there is querying, trying to find answers to complex questions. Transaction volume in the operational is high and is pretty low in the data warehouse. All we do is pretty much load. Transaction speed is critical in the operational, but it's not so critical because you could allow stuff to run for a day or two in order to get the results. The results are not needed, you know, on a daily basis or anything like that. Query activity is low on the operational and high on the DSS side, because we're always running queries against the DSS database. I mean, that's really why we have it. Scope for the operational is narrow and broad for the data warehouse. Query complexity is simple to medium in the operational, but very complex in the data warehouse environment. Data volumes in an operational are usually measured in terms of megabytes or gigabytes, but once you get into DSS, it's usually gigabytes and terabytes. Okay? So these are just some differences between the two type of databases. Now, the concept in this figure, one thing here was granularity. It was a particular characteristic. Granularity has to do with the detail or the lack thereof of the data. If there's a lot of detail, then it's very granular. If it's summarized, then it's not as granular. So it has to do with the you know, level of detail with respect to how the data is stored. Now, this concept of granularity also have relevance to a concept that is related to data warehousing. I don't know if you ever heard the term drill down or roll up. Drill down means to go further down and dig deeper into the database, but it's a lower level of granularity. For example, suppose I get a report which says the Midwest region didn't perform very well. Well, I would probably need to get more information to figure out what is the real problem, what is the root of the problem. So I may drill down to the cities and look and evaluate, you know, the revenue for each cities. And then I may drill down further into the stores in each city. And then I may discover that one store did very poorly and as a result brought the entire Midwest region down. Okay, that's the concept of drill down. The reverse of that would be to roll up. So if I start at the store level and roll up revenues into a region, that means summarizing, so to speak. So the drill down and roll up concept has to do with the ability either to dig down or to summarize data. So what is a data warehouse? Well, Inman gave us a specific definition of what a data warehouse is, and it's pretty much adopted here in the book. It says it is an integrated, subject-oriented, time-variant, non-volatile collection of data. So let's look at each of the terms. Integrated. Integrated simply means that what's in the data warehouse, the data in the data warehouse, usually comes from multiple sources, and the sources are usually operational databases scattered around the company, or some could even be external. Okay, so that's where the integration comes from. Subject-oriented. Quite often, how the data is stored relates to a particular subject matter. So for example, we could store the data for sales, we could store the data for marketing, or we could store data and advertising. So these are the topics or the areas of interest. And the, as we said, these are the, what is meant by subject-oriented. Okay. The other one is time-variant. Trends, if you want to find trends in data, trends quite often are related to time, right? Okay. Trends happen over time. So that is why the data usually have a time component to it. Okay. Whether it's years, months, weeks, whatever it turns out to be. And non-volatile means that we are not deleting stuff. Volatiles mean we add in and delete in, and that happens fairly frequently. In the data warehouse, we don't delete anything. We just keep adding. So it's non-volatile. Okay? There's not a lot of, you know, deletion and updating and things like that. Another concept I talked about in the book is called a data mat. A data mat. A data mat is like a watered-down version of what a data warehouse is. As a matter of fact, to build a data warehouse is usually expensive and risky. So some companies, rather than incurring a major expense to build a huge, humongous data warehouse, they would start out with a mat. So a data mat could very well be a small database that is designed specifically to address the needs of a small group. So suppose you have a sales function and they wanted to do some complex analysis, then you may set up a data mat just to satisfy their requirements. And you could do that for advertising and other areas throughout the company. And then at some point in time, when you have all these little mats, you could then decide to bring all these mats together, integrate them together, and then construct a full-fledged data warehouse. Now, the need for more complex business questions kind of led to this concept of OLAP. So what I'm really saying is that the need to address more complex questions, business questions, required the use of new tools and technologies, one of which is called OLAP, O-L-A-P, which stands for Online Analytical Processing. As a matter of fact, there's another one called Online Transaction Processing, OLTP, which is really the operational database side of the house. But on the warehouse side, it's called OLAP. And the analytical is associated with a decision support system. So there are four characteristics of OLAP. One is the use of multidimensional data analysis techniques. These techniques include things like 3D graphics, pivot tables, three-dimensional cubes, hypercubes, the concept of the ability to drill down, the ability to roll up, using statistical and forecasting functions, doing what-if analysis on the data, linear programming, etc. So these are, as you can see, these are highly sophisticated tools that couldn't exist in the operational database or the OLTP environment. The second one has to do with advanced database support. For example, the ability to tap into different types of databases is one type of advanced DB support. Building sophisticated navigation support to allow a user to drill down or roll up. The ability to support very large amounts of data. Okay. As a matter of fact, there's a whole research area that deals with very large databases, known as, the acronym for that is VLDB, very large databases. And there's a whole discussion group that deals with that. Whole set of issues when you have large amounts of data to support. Then the third one is to provide easy end-user interfaces, because a decision support system is supposed to be very user-friendly. So you don't have people writing SQL codes. You would have something very similar to what you find in Access, where you could use a GUI to kind of tease out data. Like in Access, they call it query by example. Okay. So fairly simple. So stuff like that is what you would have in a DSS environment. And the last one is that the ability of the OLAP to exist in a client-server environment. So those are the four characteristics. Now, the OLAP architecture is of two types. So there were two types of OLAP architecture. The first one is called ROLAP, R-O-L-A-P, and the second one is called MOLAP, M-O-L-A-P. Well, how did ROLAP get started? ROLAP gets started because most companies, just about every company, would have a relational database. And so a lot of technology and expertise exists for relational databases. And so it made a lot of sense for companies that build these type of databases, like Microsoft, SQL Server, IBM, DB2, Oracle. Since they have a lot of money invested in the technology, they decided, could we adapt our existing relational databases to support this concept of a data warehouse? And they did. And out of that came this new model, which is called ROLAP. okay, relational online analytical processing. So in order to construct a data warehouse using existing tools and technologies, they came up with a new conceptual model known as a STAR schema. And we look at that a little later. Now the MOLAP, which stands for Multidimensional Online Analytical Processing, is a proprietary technology that was developed by a particular company. And what they're doing here is trying to represent data conceptually that would be similar to the hypercube. You know that cube that kids play with? Some grown-ups do play with it too. Okay, so the concept here is that they're representing data conceptually in a manner that kind of represents that concept. That's called MOLAP. So these use a multidimensional cube structure to store the data. So ROLAP is really an extension of the relational theory applied to data warehouse to overcome some of the limitations of the operational database, such as one limitation would be handling large amounts of data, another one would be the lack of performance for such large data sets, and normalization of the data. And then MOLAP, as I said, is proprietary, and the concept is similar to the idea of a cube. Okay. Now, when a cube becomes more than three dimensions, we kind of call it a hypercube. Now, this cube usually sits in memory. That's the way the technology works. There's a particular area in memory that is known as a cube cache. You know what cache is, right? Right. So it's this large area where the actual data is stored, and that area is called a cube cache. And because the data sits in cache, you know, cache is primary memory, so it's fast. So this type of a database, if the data set is not very large, it could, you know, its performance is very good. So if you have a small to medium data set, this technology works very well performance-wise. So MOLAP cannot handle very large data sets. It would probably bog it down. So ROLAP could handle larger data sets. Now, with respect to MOLAP, there's this term called sparsity. If you could remember the concept of density, then you should be able to figure out what sparsity is. But sparsity is really a measure of the density of the data stored in the cube. So the more dense the cube is, the more sparsity you have, so to speak. So it represents the density of the data that's stored in this multidimensional cube. Now, table 13.8 there's a summary of ROLAP versus MOLAP. Is that, I think I got the wrong table. Yeah, actually, it's table. Table 13.8. If you look at that table, you'll see the difference between ROLAP and MOLAP. So let's take a look at that quickly. If you're using ROLAP, the schema, which is the underlying model, so to speak, is the STAR schema. We're going to look at that later. And then the additional dimensions are added dynamically. So we'll explain that as we go along. The MOLAP uses the concept of a data cube. The database size, medium to large for ROLAP, and small to medium for MOLAP. It's the architecture is client-server, and it's open standards. With MOLAP, it's proprietary. Access, the ROLAP supports ad hoc requests, and you could have unlimited dimensions. But in the MOLAP, the dimensions are predetermined ahead of time. And it's interesting because if you want to add more dimensions, once you construct the cube, if you want to add more dimensions, you got to deconstruct it and start all over again. So it's not very flexible. So flexibility, as you would see, is low for the MOLAP, but high for ROLAP. With ROLAP, all you got to do is add another table. The resources for ROLAP is high, but for MOLAP is very high. Scalability is low, right? Flexibility and scalability kind of go hand in hand here, but high for ROLAP. Speed for ROLAP is good with small data sets, average for medium to large data sets. For MOLAP, it's very fast for small to medium data sets, and it's average for large data sets. So it's not that it can't handle it, but the performance is slowed tremendously. Okay, so let's take a look at the star schema. The star schema is what we use to represent data in the relational environment. And basically, it looks like this. In the middle, you have what is known as a fact table. And then connected to the fact table are what are known as the dimension tables. And you could have as many of these as you see fit. So what you really have here is one and many, one and many. So this is like the many table, and these are your one tables. And I guess you should be able to realize then that your primary key for your fact table is probably going to be made up of the primary keys from the dimension tables. And sometimes that doesn't even work, depending on the nature of the data. So you may have to add another field to get entity integrity satisfied, which means uniqueness. Okay. But generally speaking, that's how it works. So this here is a very large table. And I think there's a picture in the book. What page is that on? For example, on page 521, or figure 1317, figure 1317, you'll see the fact table in the middle has 3 million records. And then the dimension tables are very small. For example, one got 25 records, one got 125 records, one got 365 records, and the largest is 3,000 records. So that's an example of a star schema. So nothing you couldn't construct here, right? Okay. So your dimension tables, are really what provides perspective. So for example, let's take a look at 1317. We got a sales table, right? And generally speaking, if this was like in Excel, you got a two-dimensional table, right? You could look at sales versus set time, and the best you can do is add one more dimension, because in Excel we could do three-dimensional graphing. But if I wanted to look at, in this case, four dimensions, I couldn't do that in Excel. Okay. So what's happening here is that I could look at sale figures from a time perspective. I could look at that from a product perspective. I can look at that from a location perspective, from a customer perspective. And there are other perspectives I could add if I see fit. Okay. So that's what, when we say we're looking for trends, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to see if there any, is there any connection between sales and time, sales and product, sales and customer, sales and location. Okay. So these are our dimension tables. So that pretty much explains the star schema. Now, there's another concept called slice and dice. Slice and dice really has to do with the fact that if I have a cube, just imagine I could take a knife and cut out a piece and kind of explore the areas that I just cut out. Okay? It's kind of the same concept we're doing here. The only difference is we're doing it with data. So it's a way of performing detailed analysis on the data. Okay? It is as if you were cutting through the cube to explore various dimensions. Okay? So that's what we mean by slice and dice. Now, to perform drill down and roll up, you have to define ahead of time a path through which this may be done. So you have to define what is known as an attribute hierarchy, which is a top-down data organization structure that facilitates the drill down process. So for example, earlier I said to you, suppose I had data for sales. I could start by exploring the sales at the region level, right? Then I could come down to cities in the region. Then I could come down to stores in the city. Now, in order for that type of drill down to take place, somebody has to define ahead of time the attributes that are involved and the sequence of the attributes. So you would have to define the region, the city, you know, the stores within the city, and so that would create what is known as an attribute hierarchy. You'd have to define that ahead of time, and once it is defined, then you could set up the structure to allow a user to then drill down based on that hierarchy. So these things have to be defined ahead of time. Okay? If you don't define them, then there's no drill down capability. Okay? So that is the purpose of the attribute hierarchy. Okay, to facilitate this concept of drill down and roll up. So you have to define them a priori, which is ahead of time. And if you look on figure 13.15, you will see an example of an attribute hierarchy. Somebody defined the region, then they defined the state within the region, then the city, and then the store. Okay? So they have a four-attribute hierarchy. And you could have as many as you see fit. There's no, you know, no limit, at least conceptually there. There's no limit to how deep you can go. Now, there are four techniques that can be used to optimize warehouse design. And the optimization really has to do with two primary things. One is performance, and the other one is semantics. For example, you could decide to normalize, even though we don't usually normalize the data in the warehouse, we could choose to normalize the dimensional tables. Okay? And if you look on figure 13.19, you would see an example of that. For example, you know, they broke out the state and city separately. Okay. So you could choose to normalize, you know, the tables if you see fit. But you got to realize, as you normalize, you lose performance, right? You now have more tables. So there must be good reason why you're normalizing. Another thing you can do to speed up performance is that you could have several fact tables. For example, if you have a very large fact table, it could very well slow down the performance. So what some companies would do is they would partition the fact table into two or more, however many you see fit. And then you have the dimension tables hanging off of a smaller table. So it would take less time to query. Okay? So that's possible. If for some reason your fact table is normalized, which most of the time that's unlikely, you could decide to denormalize that. And we've talked about that before in the operational environment, where companies denormalize their data a lot of times because it speeds performance. And another thing you could do is you could do partitioning and replication of the data. Okay? So you could choose to partition the fact table because it's so large and spread it out over multiple geographical sites. So these are those four techniques for optimizing the warehouse design. Now, there's a concept that you're probably going to hear, in reference to data warehousing, and it's called data mining. Well, you know what mining is? As you mine coal, you dig down and try to find. Well, the same thing here. Data mining means we're trying to dig into the data to find. What are we trying to find? It's not coal in this case. It's trends in the data, opportunities. Okay? So you're trying to find out why customers are purchasing whatever they purchase. When is a good time that they usually purchase these products? You know, when is a good time to drop your price? How much should you drop it by? Okay. What are some customers buying in the middle of the year or in the winter or whatever the case is? You know. So you're trying to use that information to your advantage so you could actually move the company in a different position to get some sort of competitive advantage. That's what most companies are using this for. So data mining is nothing more than a fancy term for querying. It's just that in the data warehousing, querying is a lot more complex. In the data warehouse, as you see, we do things like forecasting, regression analysis, regression splines, correlation analysis. So we're using a lot of statistics to understand the data, to understand the trends in the data, to unravel the mystery in the data. We don't do that on the operational side. Those tools don't exist. So this is where the complexity of the data warehouse comes into play, because we're using a lot more sophisticated tools in order to understand the complexity of the data. So data mining is on the data warehouse side, but in some sense it's equivalent to the watered-down version of that, which is querying on the operational side. So, as I said previously, data mining is nothing more than trying to analyze, to uncover problems or opportunities hidden in the data, and to formulate models that may be then used to forecast or predict the business in some future time frame. So data mining usually has four steps. One, it has data preparation. And the data preparation goes back to what I said earlier about extracting the data from the operational data warehouse, from the operational database, and cleaning it. Okay, that's the preparation. Then the next step in data mining is to analyze and classify, you know, these patterns that you're finding. So you're trying to identify patterns and classifying them and characterizing them. Then once that is done, you then move to the third stage, which is the acquisition of knowledge. Okay? It's like when you put data in Excel and you run graphs, that would be kind of like the classification. The graphs then enlighten you, and from that you can say, oh, okay, now I see what's going on. That's the third phase. That's the acquisition of the knowledge phase. Now that you understand the message in the data. And then now that you understand the message in the data, you could then take action, which is the fourth step. Okay? You could then try to predict customer behavior or industry trends, whatever. So you're now positioning the company to react to what you anticipate or what you find in the data. So these are the four data mining steps. In some sense, that pretty much captures the information in this chapter. So pretty much the stuff we talked about, SQL extensions for rollup, you probably won't find anything on the exam there. You may just want to pass it for your own benefit, but I won't tease out any questions from that section.